Okay, today we're going to talk about miracles. What a miracle is, what kinds of miracles there are, how we can know that miracles are taking place. There are some interesting philosophical arguments against believing in miracles. David Hume started that 30, 50 years ago. So, we'll see how far we'll get this week. There's some interesting classification of miracles and what they're supposed to achieve. Seeing as how in the week of Hanukkah is dedicated to celebrating the miracle, so we should spend some time in reflection on that. I'll just start with something which a question I won't answer for 2 days, but it seems it is something for you to think about. You can ask other people and see what reactions you get. We light the menorah because of the miracle of the oil. They found a container of oil that could naturally burn for one day, and it burned very quickly. We're also celebrating the fact that there was a war, and we won the war. Now, if you look at Al-Nisim, that special paragraph that you add to the davening and to the benching, which you say after meals, you look at it, look at what it says, you will notice that there is no mention of the miracle of the oil at all. The miracle of the oil isn't mentioned at all. All that's mentioned is the war. Okay, who knows why that is? Maybe you could dream up a reason. But when you are standing there lighting the menorah, as you light the menorah, there's a paragraph that you are supposed to say. And there's halalu anamadikim, alanisim, alanifalos, be'alam. That's your use of alanifalos. Shosisho, alasein, alayim, alanazah, b'nei, alatishahu. I think, kodnecha, hachadoshim. We're lighting these miracles because of the wonders and the miracles and wars that you did for our ancestors, the time of the Maccabim, and all the 8 days, the lights are holy, you can't do anything with them, only to look at them. Even when you are lighting the candles, you don't mention the miracle of the oil. You don't mention it. All you say is the guy fought wars for us. Very nice. Okay. My gosh, you know, you're lighting the candles. And you're lighting the candles because of the miracle of the oil. And you have a little formula, 35 words long or so, depending upon your hearsay. And you say it as you light the candles, and you don't mention the miracle of the oil. That's very strange. That's very peculiar. So, think about that. Ask people what they say. I'll get to it in a couple of days. Okay, so let's start. What is a miracle? The simplest, most common thing to say is that a miracle is a break in nature. There are laws of nature. Laws of nature run almost all the time. From time to time, God interferes and makes something happen against the laws of nature. Water flows downhill. Occasion, thereby breaking the law of gravity, or stones fall from the sky, or hail appears with fire inside, or the sea splits, or the firstborn of the Egyptians die, or one night's worth of oil burns very nice. The idea of a miracle would be something that breaks the laws of nature. Now, I think from our point of view, that definition is really completely wrong. It's a completely wrong definition. And it's wrong in at least 2 different ways. First of all, not every break in the laws of nature will be what we would call a miracle. You can have breaks in the laws of nature, which should not be called miracles. And secondly, the whole idea of breaking the laws of nature gives too much credit to nature. The whole idea is very misleading because it seems to say that there is something there to be broken, whereas our view would be that there's nothing there to be broken, and which would mean then that you'd have to understand the idea of miracle in a different way altogether. Let's start with the first idea, which is a simpler idea. Let's imagine that something happens which violates the laws of nature in a very dramatic way, and for which we have no explanation. Here's the example that I usually give, but you could think of any number of examples. As we are sitting here talking, right over the table, there materializes a Parker pen. Just pops out of nowhere. And it sits there, hanging in the air. And the point is extended. And it's sort of making lazy motions back and forth and around and around. Somebody has the presence of mind to stick a piece of paper under it and traces figures on the paper. And it does this for about 10 minutes, and then it just disappears. Now, we all see this, and we have the piece of paper afterwards. Maybe there are people here with cameras, you know, and they take pictures, you know, because it's such an interesting thing. And it's very surprising, and nothing like this has ever been reported to have happened anywhere, anytime. And we call in the Stanford University Physics Department to do an examination of the whole building and the floor and the lighting and very thin transparent wires hanging down from the ceiling and it becomes a real mystery. None of us has been drinking. I mean, this is really only 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Give us a chance. If it was midnight, I could say something else. But it's Hanukkah, so most guys aren't shooting up. I mean, it's a time where people are really, sober and calm. Now, let's imagine no one ever discovers any explanation for this. Would that be a miracle? Well, I don't want to play games with the word miracle, but from our point of view, the answer is no. That's not what we would call a miracle. I doubt, frankly, that other religions would call it a miracle either. From what I've read about the concept of miracle, most would not think of that as a miracle. Even though we would have very good reason to think that it was a break in the laws of nature, because according to the laws of nature, Parker pens don't just materialize out of nowhere and then disappear into nowhere. But it wouldn't be. Why? Because the concept of a miracle is not a scientific concept or a philosophical concept, it's a religious concept. A miracle is an event that shows God's agency. If you want a definition, that's the definition. A miracle is an event that shows God's agency. You can see God's agency in the event. Let me put it a little sharper. That the God's agency in the event is obvious. It's obvious, revealed, open, clear, without mystery. Same guy. It's the most big question. It's an event where any honest, objective, sane person would have to admit that it's God's agency. Now, when I say any honest, sane person, I'm not being trivial. After all, A.J. Ayer, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century, Alfred Jules Ayer, who came from a mixed marriage, one of his parents was Jewish, although I don't remember which one, said that if he had stood at Sinai, and together with all the Jews at Sinai had heard God speak, he would have gone to the nearest psychiatrist because that would have proved that he was crazy. You see, there can't be a God. It's impossible. And if I hear him speak, that means I'm crazy because there can't be a God. That's what I would say is a failure of objectivity, a failure of openness, a failure of honesty. So barring that, a person who is objective and honest and fair will have to take this as God's agency. That's what a miracle is for us. Not just a quirk. You know what a quirk means? Quirk means something which is just strange. Just strange, out of the ordinary, and perhaps inexplicable, but just strange. No, it's not enough that it be strange. It's not enough, therefore, that it just break the laws of nature. That's not enough. It's got to break the laws of nature in such a way that you can see God's hand in doing so. That anybody who was there would appreciate that it had to be so. How could that be? One way it could be is that it's predicted by a prophet in God's name. You have an event which human beings cannot engineer, and which is predicted by someone who says he speaks in God's name, and it happens. And it happens in accordance with a purpose that is, we know from prior events or from what this person teaches, is one of God's purposes. So if we are told by Moses that God wants to save the Jewish people from Egypt and will do so no matter what opposition the Egyptians muster, and the Egyptians are very obstinate, and the plagues start to happen, and Moses says, it's happening tomorrow at 11:30, set your watches, and you'll see that it happens at that time. And it'll last for a week, or Pharaoh says to Moses, you know, I can't take this anymore, get rid of it, and Moses says, you choose the time. Don't say that I'm a magician. Don't say that I know the secret to that. You choose the time. Whatever time you choose, I'll get it to stop. And Pharaoh says, well, tomorrow, which means he's putting up with the plague for another 24 hours. Brave guy. You know, because it's very disturbing, this plague. But he doesn't want, he's right. Moses is right. I say now, so maybe he's just coming to see me now because he knows it's going to stop anyway. No, I'll pick a time. Good. If it's tomorrow, stops tomorrow. You see the Egyptian army bearing down on the Jews, and just before they're about to be slaughtered, the sea opens up, and the cloud goes in between the two of them and stops the Egyptians in their track. And the Jews go across, and then the Egyptians come in, and the water collapses on them. You saw that. You witnessed that. There'll be no question in your mind that, as the Egyptians themselves said, God is fighting for the Jews. This is what we mean by a miracle. Of course, it has to break nature. That'd be my next comment. But it has to break nature. It can't just be a natural event. Because if it's a natural event, then you can't see that God did it at all. But breaking nature is not enough. It's not enough. It's got to break nature plus. It's got to break nature in such a way that you can see it as God's agency. What I want to contradict or deny here is this. There are people who know the truth that God is running the world, and they watch the sunrise, and they say, wow, look at God, look at that gorgeous, inspiring sunrise. And they see God's hand in the sunrise. Now here, the word see takes on a different meaning. Here it means, I know, and because I know how to interpret what I see, and I'm interpreting it in the light of my knowledge. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about interpreting, where one person who has the knowledge can interpret, another person who doesn't have the knowledge can't interpret. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a case that doesn't need any interpretation. Crossing the Red Sea, watching the sea part, doesn't require any prior knowledge with which you interpret what happens. It's just observed. Whereas sunrise If you have the appropriate knowledge, then you can interpret it correctly. If you don't have the appropriate knowledge, you won't see it. It's a little bit like molecules. Everyone knows that this table is made of molecules. You might, if you're sort of hypnotized by science, sort of picture in your mind's eye a kind of latticework with very thin filaments and lots of empty space. Empty space is space, and the rest of it is the molecules in the sort of attaching to one another and making a rigid filament structure. You picture that in your mind. But you're not seeing the molecules. You're taught in science classes made of molecules, and you are picturing it in your mind. That's when you're interpreting the table. Similarly, you can interpret a sunrise. You can interpret it as God's action. That doesn't mean you see it as God's action. You don't see it. It's not open, obvious, manifest, revealed that God is doing this. A person doesn't know about God, or a person doesn't believe in God, can look at the same sunrise. He sees all the colors you see, he just then doesn't interpret it your way. That's not true about the crossing of the Red Sea. A person who would stand there and say, oh, I guess it was just an accident, though we have no way to explain it, it's never happened before, and it never happens again, that person is not honest. That person is not open. That person is not objective. And therefore, that would qualify as a miracle, whereas the Parker pen does not qualify as a miracle. Yeah.
So then, these miracles that we see every day, we can't really use miracles. Is that why, saying like Modi Manachnulach, we say wonders?
Okay, so you're right. The truth is, the word miracle in Hebrew is used in two different ways, just to make life complicated. And indeed, in the same book, in the same author, it could be used in two different ways. It's an ambiguous word. Some split up the world into miracles and non-miracles. Like the Shulchan Aruch, the Book of Jewish Law. Here's a halacha, you can either see it or consider. If you had a miracle happen to you at a certain place, and you go by that place again, you should make a special blessing. Blessing to God, God did a miracle for me in this place. Now let's see. If I go past the place where I drank a glass of water, should I say this blessing? Probably not, right? I mean, I'm saying the blessing all day long, all the time. Now, if you talk, the way the sitter does, but I was surrounded by miracles all the time, so isn't the function of the body a miracle? Sure, it's a miracle. Come on, get into the right spirit, guys. You know, work up a sweat. So it's clearly a miracle. Everything's a miracle. You know, gravity's a miracle. So then I'd be making the blessing all the time. Obviously, the Shulchan Aruch is not using the word miracle that way. The Shulchan Aruch divides the world into miracle and non-miracle. Miracle is what I said. An event that clearly shows God's agency. And everything else is not a miracle according to this usage of the word. There's another usage. Like the Ramban, the end of Parshas Bo, and this is what the Siddur is training on, which divides the world into revealed miracles and hidden miracles. And what we call nature, says the Ramban, is really a hidden miracle. There's a different meaning for the word miracle. It's a different meaning. Here, the word miracle means anything that God does directly, coming directly from God's will. Then, the Ramban is telling you that everything is a miracle in that sense. Everything comes directly from God's will. So then, the only difference is whether you see it or you don't. So, you just have to be careful when you're reading a book with the word miracle in it to make sure you know which definition of miracle is using. In the passage in the Siddur, which you quoted, that's using the other definition. Then, a miracle is something which God directly does. And then sometimes you see it and sometimes you don't. I would use the other definition that you find in Halacha, that a miracle is something that you clearly see as God's agency. Yeah?
Which is why you define a miracle like that. If you have something that goes against the laws of nature, and there's no way to scientifically prove why that happens. Okay, so for instance, if I throw a book, and it doesn't go down, and it defies the laws of gravity, and just kind of hangs out in midair, and then it does what it does, whenever it does, that's to find the laws of gravity. There's no way to prove why maybe there was a magnet here, this and that. There's no way to prove that there was something else scientifically to prove it. Why is that not a miracle also? Why do you have to see the hand of God?
Well, as I said, I don't want to fight about the word. I'm not interested.
I'm
no. I didn't mean it that way either. The subject is not how to understand the English word M-I-R-A-C-L-E. That's not the subject.
That's how it's spelled in the mind. You notice that?
What's that?
We're now discussing miracles, M-I-R-I-C-L-E.
What you said? Oh, I did not notice that. I would have penned in a correction. Didn't even have a spell check. You know. You'd have to know to press the button. Everything.
I agree.
Lazy body. I'm defining a concept that we use in the Torah, nace, right? I'm defining it the way we use it. So if in the New York Times, when they talk to Goyim, they use the word miracle differently, that's up to them. I don't care how they use it. I said I'm not discussing now how to define the English word miracle. I'm defining the religious concept of a miracle. And I said that I'm defining the Jewish concept, and I said, as far as I know, from other religions also, they will not accept what they will call a miracle as just an exception to the laws of nature. That's not enough. After all, maybe I'll fill you in a little more. After all, how tight are the laws of nature altogether? How tight are they? Richard Feynman, in one of his books, quotes a philosopher. He loved to make fun of philosophers. Philosophers sit in their armchairs with their eyes closed and dream up ideas, and he says, you know, if you open your eyes and take a look at the real world, you'll often find that philosophy just is dead wrong. And he quotes one philosopher who said, the foundation of science is that if you set up an experiment and run it and get a result, then if you set up exactly the same experimental conditions again, you'll get the same result. Repeatability of the experiment. That's the absolute foundation of science. So Feynman said, if that's the foundation of science, then, my dear students, you should know that science has no foundation. Because in quantum mechanics, you can set up an experiment and run exactly the same experiment and get very different results. That's the way the world is. The world doesn't repeat like that. It's just not fixed like that. So you'd better open your eyes and change your definition of science. Why end up with the conclusion there is no science when the conclusion is, and just realize that science doesn't have to work that way. There is an element of chance built in at the very foundation of our world. It's not that we're ignorant of what can happen. It's that if you knew everything, you wouldn't know what's going to happen. That's the way they explain it. You can know everything that there is to know, and still what happens is a matter of chance. Now, as of now, so far as we know, that's on the micro scale. That's only with little particles. Particles so small you can't even see them in a microscope. We're all made up of little bitty particles, number one. And number two, you could connect those itty-bitty particles to a big effect, like triggering a bomb. And then it would come out that in principle, nothing determines when the bomb goes off. You know what a Geiger counter is, right? A Geiger counter counts radioactive decay. Radioactive decay is something which has no cause. The atom disintegrates when it feels like it. There is nothing that makes it go now or later. So you send up this atom and get a Geiger counter and then attach it to a bomb. When the bomb goes off, it's completely undetermined. Now imagine little things attached to big things. But we could imagine that our universe was that way about big things also. After all, the universe is what it is. And we just open our eyes, take a look, and see how it is. Now, just imagine our universe is that way about Parker pens. You know, they just sort of come and go. You know, they come sometimes, and they go other times. They just no rhyme or reason, they just come and go. No one in any religious circles is going to regard this as a miracle, even if it has no scientific explanation.
What's the good of Parker pens?
Oh, they're the greatest pens. I've been flying them for 30 years. Here's my partner. I always use Parker pens.
Why?
They're smooth, they don't skip, they don't blot, you know, they're very good. And they're cheap. They're cheap. Yeah.
It's been like radioactive today. Is there a distinction between science not having an explanation now and science not having an explanation? If you were asked to ask a scientist about radioactive decay, is there no rhyme or reason in science where he's going to say there's some force or some effect that science has not yet discovered, and that's why radioactive decay seems random to us?
As a matter of fact, no. As a matter of fact, the difference between there being a hidden force that we haven't discovered, on the one hand, and there being absolutely no force, on the other hand,
That difference is open to experimental test. That was on the basis of John Bell's theorem, famous Bell's theorem in the 1960s and 70s. And they tested it. And it turns out that the hypothesis that there's a hidden force is against what the experiment tells us. Sounds unbelievable, but that the official theory is that there is no force to be discovered. There is no force to be discovered. David Bohm tried to think up a kind of pseudo-force that would do the job, but his theory is very much in disrepair. The official story, quantum mechanics, is there is nothing to be discovered. Chance is the elementary characteristic of our world. They put it this way, even God can't know in advance. If all he has available to him is everything that's true now, even God can't predict the future. He might know the future some other way, but he can't predict it on the basis of what. Because it isn't there. The fact isn't there. It's not that we're missing it, but the fact itself isn't there. Yeah.
From time to time here in Israel, I see melon plants growing out of ground so dry you wouldn't expect even dandelions can grow from it. I've even seen melon plants growing out of cracks in a sidewalk. Should that be regarded as a miracle?
I don't know. This now, as I said, violating the laws of nature is part of the definition, but not the whole definition. And here you have to know the laws of botany, and I have no idea how to, whether it is or isn't.
I've never seen that in full
Yeah, I don't know what to say. Yeah.
I walked Rabbi Rosenberg home from the wedding Tuesday night, and on the long walk back, he told me that he was sitting at the dentist's office, and there were a bunch of magazines on the table. The only ones that were kosher that he could read was National Geographic. And I picked it up and read about physics and all the studies that they're doing with quantum mechanics now. And he said he almost fell off his chair because it sounds like Kabbalah. It sounds more and more like Kabbalah, and that the people in physics that are purporting that the uncertainty in everything is what guides the world are known as the priests.
Yeah, okay, it's true. But it is, in certain respects, it is a matter of... Kabbalah or
I just see when you said uncertainty and everything has an uncertainty to it, he says, I mean, that's what we have been saying in Kabbalah. He explained it to me, but I didn't understand what he was saying.
Yeah, and it's more basically well, consciousness, it's you know, we're in a very funny position. If somebody builds a machine and it does something, usually you ask him why it does it, and he can tell you, like, because he built it, and he knows, you know, this thing works like this, that thing works like that. And that's how it does what it does. In fundamental science, what you do is you build a theory. And the job of the theory is to predict what will happen and to explain why it happens. Quantum mechanics is the most fabulous, efficient predictor of what will happen that we have ever had. Some effects can be predicted to 15 decimal places. It's fabulously accurate in terms of ability to predict. But to explain why it's happening, at last count there were 8 different fundamental explanations, and they all disagree with each other. No one knows why it works. No one knows how it works. Just if you use the equations, it works, but what's the reality that it's describing? No one has a clue why it should do the things that it does. So it's really a puzzling situation. Anyway, so all I'm intending to demonstrate is the fact that merely breaking the laws of nature is not going to be enough for us, for our concept of a miracle. Us has got to show God's agency, which means it'll have to break the laws of nature, plus be religiously significant in some way, have some kind of religious meaning. Okay. Now, let's go back to the idea of breaking the laws of nature. Breaking the laws of nature. Here's the picture then. God creates the world. Part of the world is nature, which are laws. The part that's nature is sort of made to happen. It happens all by itself. Sometimes God, as we said, intervenes and says, oh, I know how gravity works. Gravity cools the water down, but I want the water to go up. So on this occasion, out of thousands of years and millions of square miles, God says, at this time, in this place, I want the water to go up and not down. So the law is suspended, broken, however you like to put it. The rest of the time, the law is working all by itself. From the point of view of most Jewish sources, and I would say probably all, but that's controversial. There's a controversy about whether there's a controversy. That's the same fact. But for many, for most I would say, the whole idea of laws of nature is a mistake. The whole idea that there are laws, that the world runs on its own, that if God sort of lets it go, it carries on its own. And then from time to time, he stirs the soup. You know, he just sticks the spoon in and gives a push. Mixes up the children. That's a mistake, because there really aren't laws of nature. There's nothing that makes things happen. That whole description is a mistake. Really what's going on is that God is creating the universe over and over again, moment by moment. Moment by moment, it's really a new universe. And therefore, he creates it as he pleases. And each moment is a separate creation. And that means each moment is entirely separate, independent. No moment has any effect on the next moment. They're all completely different.
How long is the moment, right?
Quantum mechanics says it's about 10 to the minus 34 seconds. That's a minus 35. Down at the Planck distance, the Planck time, that's where the latest speculations say that time becomes actually discontinuous. Time becomes discrete. Time becomes discrete. The space becomes discrete.
What is that? Why can't I guess the limit in the limit is possible?
Because there aren't small units of time. I mean, why can't it be? It's not a question of chance, it's a question of what is. And according to them, that's all there is. This is what super string theory says, and quantum gravity says, the latest speculations. And when you get down small enough, space and time are like a foam of bubbles, and it's not really continuous all the way down to the bottom. But this is an empirical question. It's not something you can decide. It's like what Feynman said to the philosopher. You know, you can't decide this closing your eyes and sitting in your armchair. Gosh, I'd like it to be continuous. It's not a question of what you'd like. It's just a question of what is. And, you know, Einstein introduced the revolution. He said, time is what you measure. You have a measuring technique. Time is what you get when you apply the measuring technique. Space is what you measure. When you take rods and put them one after another, from one end of the room to the other, space is what you get when you measure. Fundamental characteristics of the world are defined by a measuring process and the result of the measuring process. They don't depend on reality. That was a fundamental term, philosophically, methodologically, physics, when Einstein said, time is what clocks measure. There is no other thing. And if clocks work in jerks, then that's all you're going to get. Very, very small jerks, but jerks nonetheless. Okay. Now, why? This is a radical idea that Rav Dessler is expressing, although David Hume did write about this and was famous for it. Do you mean every moment is a separate moment? What would that mean about cause and effect? Cause and effect, usually the cause happens and the effect happens. So, I throw a stone and hits a glass, and the glass breaks. Right? So I guess the cause is the stone hits the glass, and the effect is the glass going to pieces. If you had a very fine camera, you'd be able to see. The stone hits the glass starts to bend, and then at a certain point, the bending is too much for the glass to hold together, and then it goes into pieces and shatters. Right? This is a whole process. Now, if every moment is a new creation, what we're saying is there's really no connection between the stone hitting the glass and the glass breaking. It's just this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. But each thing that happened is an entirely separate thing. How could we think of the world? How do we think of the world without understanding that one thing makes another thing happen? So Rav Dester in his way, and Mahatma David Hume in his way, ask us to think about what it means for one thing to cause another thing. Here's the picture that I think is intuitive. This is what we feel. And then they're going to attack this picture. Let's imagine a case like this. I throw the stone. The stone hits the glass bends and then breaks. Just at the moment that my stone hits the glass, the clock chimes. The grandfather clock in the corner chimes. And the glass breaks. So now, we say, well, you understand, the chiming of the clock and the breaking of the glass, there's no real connection there. That's just an accident. It didn't the chiming of the clock that broke the glass. It was my stone that broke the glass. The stone broke the glass. The chiming of the clock was just in the background. It really, didn't do anything. I hope we can all agree on this. It wasn't the chiming of the clock. Good. Now, they ask, how do you know that? What exactly do you mean? If I look very carefully at the stone hitting the glass, I have this very fine camera, it takes, 100 frames a second, and I run the frames very slowly, so what do I see? I see that stone comes in contact, the glass bends, and then sheds. Of course, if this film has sound in it, I also see here the clock chimes, the glass bends and breaks. So they're both on the film. The stone is on the film, and the chiming of the clock is on the film. And they're both just before the glass breaks. Now, how come I say it's the stone that did it and not the chiming of the clock?
Yeah. There has to be something in between a cosmic effect that makes it happen.
So I guess that would mean that in the case of the stone, I see something else, something extra.
Right.
I see something extra. Okay. What have I seen up till now? I saw the stone hits, the glass bends, and it breaks. But of course I hear the chiming of the clock, the glass bends, and it breaks. Now you suggest there must be something else. So let's run the frames by more slowly. Let's say it's 1,000 frames a second, okay? So run them by very slowly. Can you give me any idea what extra thing I'm going to see? I see the glass bending very slowly. Because it's 1,000 frames a second now. And I'll see it shattering very slowly. What's the extra thing I'm going to see with the stone to the glass shattering versus the chiming of the clock to the glass shattering? What's the extra thing?
An angel breaking.
Imagine that the air in the room is colored pink. And you're a very fast camera, and you see the sound waves. You see the air compressing and diluting, and the sound wave hits the glass also.
Repeat the process.
Oh, but that's not something inside. That's something outside. Now you've taken the right step, but it's a radically new, different step. Your first thought was, there's got to be something in there, between the cause and the effect, some extra thing, some kind of glue, some kind of connecting, some kind of keeper, sort of making it happen, right? Now you've said, look at other cases. Of course, the obvious thing is to point out that in the last 1,000 hours when the clock struck its chime, the glass didn't break, right? But that's not looking deeper into this event to see where the connection is. That's comparing it with other events. That's the right answer, but it means it needs to give up the ship. That's giving up the whole philosophy.
At the risk of not really being able to express this very well, isn't that what a law of physics is? Even if you're looking through Hume or Dessler, so even if you're looking at a new universe each second, the law of physics still says that when I pick up the rock and throw it,
However many universes later, given the inertia and momentum of the rock, it will shatter the glass, whereas however many universes after the sound waves begin emitting from the clock, and those will not shatter the glass.
Good. So then, all the law is, the law and the idea of cause and effect is just that regularly, when stones of a certain momentum, as you say, come in contact with the glass shatters, and regularly when clocks chime, glass doesn't shatter. That's all we're being told. It's just that these sorts of things happen over and over and over again, and those sorts of things don't happen over and over and over again. In other words, inside, there's no difference at all. There's no more forcing, pushing, connecting, Hume's word was necessitating, that the stone has an effect on the glass. For all we could know, maybe clocks will do it and stones won't do it. Who knows? Just open your eyes and take a look at the world and see what happens. And all we have is regularities. We have that these kinds of things happen regularly and those kinds of things don't happen regularly. The opposite happens regularly. That's all we have. That is fully compatible with saying that the universe is created anew every moment. Just that God creates it according to a pattern. God is committed to certain kinds of patterns. But it means that when the cause happens, there is nothing which necessitates the effect happening. The effect doesn't have to happen. It just generally happens, usually happens, and we get used to it happening, and we expect it happening. That's the way our psychology is built. But nothing forces it to happen. In which case, the idea of breaking a law of nature, as if the law of nature had some reality, it had some power, some force. It's going. It's going. And I need something to counteract it and stop it. It's a complete mistake. The idea is a complete mistake. What we call the law of nature is just the way things usually happen. And in this case, it happened that way. That's all. Which is not the way people usually think. And it is certainly not the way scientists typically think, and since Hume introduced his critique of causation, there has been a gigantic discussion for 250 years, how to understand causation. Some think that Hume understood it that way, just as patterns, although Hume gave two definitions of cause within two pages of each other, which contradict one another, which is, for Hume, that was really a celebrated conundrum that he should do such a thing. And one would make it just a pattern, the other would not make it just a pattern, you give a counterfactual definition. That's a mess. But this is the idea that we're talking about. And what Rodester points out, as I said, similar to the way Hume does it, that there is no reason to see it otherwise. There's no reason to say that when the cause happens, the effect must happen. Yes?
Don't humans break the laws of nature every couple of seconds when they fall out of a plane? You just have to look at things abstractly, like in an abstract way. So,
which law of nature is broken?
Well, humans can't fly, right? Like, they don't have wings. But you fly in an airplane, so you can defy that law.
Which law? The law that humans can't fly flapping their arms?
Yeah. I'm not sure who wrote that.
But let's say so. But then, when you fly in a plane, you're not flapping your arms, are you?
Right, but you're still flying.
But that wasn't the law. The law was you can't fly flapping your arms. Are you breaking that law?
No,
not breaking that law. Not that law. And there is no law that you can't fly in a plane.
Right.
No natural law. No law of nature. No, it's not so easy to break the laws of nature. And I'm skipping over a lot of complicated stuff. Does it mean to break a law of nature? If you broke it, would it just mean that it wasn't a law and you would have to get another law? Okay, it's a concept. Yeah.
But I thought when we're looking at miracles, we're looking for the unexplained effect, not the unexplained cause.
Yes, the unexplained effect, that's correct. So,
I thought you were just talking about unexplained causes.
No. What I was saying was, the difference between the stone and the window going to pieces versus the clock and the window going to pieces is only that every time stones like that, if windows like that, they go to pieces. And every time clocks like that chime with windows like that, they don't go to pieces. But there's nothing in this stone and this window which You know, makes it happen. So that once the stone gets there, it's got to happen. You see, if you thought there was a glue here, if you thought there was something, a forcing, a necessitating, when the cause happens, the effect has to happen, and somebody tells you it didn't happen over there, you feel a strong resistance. What do you mean? The cause happens, fella. It's got to happen. It's forced to happen. Now, what this picture does is deprive you of the idea of force altogether. There's no force. They're just patterns. You say, well, okay, there are patterns. I don't know why there are such patterns. And now this time the pattern didn't happen. Do I have any objection in principle against that? Why should I have an objection? There's a pattern and it happens lots and lots of the time. This time it didn't happen. So what? Because you thought it was something that made it happen. Then you say, I'm sorry. There's an engine here that's producing this. And you're telling me that you went against the engine. How did you manage that? You have a stronger engine? Prove it to me. Once you realize there's no engine, then the resistance against the idea of a miracle is greatly reduced.
How would you relate the concept of a miracle to the Arab-Israeli wars of the past half century?
See, in an area where it's very difficult to know what the laws are, it's also very difficult to know what a miracle is. And here, the more complicated the thing is, the more difficult it is to know what the laws really are supposed to be. Yes, if you ask the experts, they will tell you that the war, especially the 6-7 war, is very, very difficult to explain. But to come down hard and fast and say that a miracle has happened, you have to believe that you have in hand all the laws that apply, and you know them well, and you can see that as an exception. And the more complicated the phenomenon is, war is a trillion times more complicated than water just rising out of his bed. That's what she said. All right, we'll continue tomorrow.